Brent and I Talk on Twitter. Start at 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, gentlemen, we are back live on the air, and we have a very special roundtable that is headed up by not only myself, but Joe Rossi, Peter Brown, and Christine James has joined us in the room. And we have four police chiefs from around the South Shore. It's kind of a South Shore type of thing. We get a chance to have them in to talk about not only about policing, talk about their departments, what policing is like, some of the issues that they face on a regular basis. And on your radio dial, let me see if I'm doing this correctly, it might be from left to right. We'll start with Mr. Richard Wall. He is the chief in Pembroke. And we have Mr. Phil Tavares, chief in Marshfield. Next to him is Scott Benton, chief in Whitman. And next to him is Chief Russ Jenkins from Braintree. Gentlemen, welcome to Monday Night Talk. And thank you very much for agreeing to come on down and talking with us about a very important job, somebody who presides over a police department and the protection and the safety of our citizens here in on the South Shore. Would you agree, Christine?
I would concur, Kevin.
Is there anything you'd like to weigh in and say?
Well, I'd like... We always have great cooperation with local law enforcement. Anytime we're asking for stories or information, I've been here a long time, 24 years, believe it or not, and the relationship like that between the press and law enforcement wasn't always that cooperative. It's changed tremendously, and I'd say the past 15 years, so thanks to these guys, these local departments, makes our job a lot easier. Appreciate it.
All right. What we'll do is we'll start from right to left, and we'll introduce who you are and say a little bit about, to talk to us about who you are and a little bit about your department. We'll start with Chief Jenkins from Braintree, if you will.
Well, Braintree is a community of about 35,000 people. Our department's 81 strong. We have five recruits in the academy right now. That brings us up to a total of 81. And we have 9 civilian dispatchers and a support staff of 7 civilians who work in our reports, in our record section and building maintenance, animal control. Maintain the police 911 system at our station, and we'll soon be doing 5 dispatch as well.
All right. Just a one thing. Make sure you talk right into the microphone, gentlemen. When it's your turn to talk, we'll go with Chief Benton, if you will. Talk right into that mic. Don't be shy.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about your department and yourself, if you like.
Okay. We serve about 14,500 people next to the city of Brockton. We have 26 full-time officers. We have 2 reserves and about 20 special auxiliaries. And we also cover animal control and crossing guards. So there's quite a bit of stuff going on, you know, in the town of Whitman. We're pretty busy. Like most communities, you know, quality of life issues are probably, you know, what we deal with the most. And as everybody has the opiates, which are just, you know, epidemic. I do think that even as a state, we're starting to address those. We're recognizing it. But, you know, that's pretty much what, you know, where we're at in Whitman anyway.
Okay. And next to it, sliding the microphone down, we have right here in our very own yard is Chief Tavares of Marshfield. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your department.
Sure. We have a population of just a little over 25,000. In the summer, our population swells up to 40,000. We have 44 full-time officers. We're down currently 16 officers. We should be staffed somewhere around 60. We're in charge of a number of different departments, police, harbor master, animal control, animal inspector, emergency management, beaches. We've got 2 major river systems and a harbor and an extensive coastline, and it's difficult to patrol with such, you know, short staffing.
Chief Wall, if you will, from Pembroke.
In Pembroke, we're just shy of 20,000 people, and we've picked up quite a lot of commuter traffic and everything else with the 139 projects that have gone on over the last couple of years. Pembroke's still a nice bedroom community. The police department's 27 full-time. 2 full-time civilian workers and 15 part-time.
I guess the first thing I got to ask you, gentlemen, I mean, you are all the administrators of your department. What are some of the challenges you face as a chief when it comes to, I mean, it's not an ordinary where you just, you know, find out what your sergeants and lieutenants are doing as far as sending patrols out. It's a lot more in depth, is it not?
Well, there are increasing demands on us, quite frankly. There's new laws being passed every day that we have to address and we have to prepare for, have to educate our officers to deal with more professional like that. So the job has changed dramatically. More is expected of us. Without a doubt, there's a huge drug problem in all our communities. No town, no city is exempt from that. It's how we address it that defines us. We have a big mental health problem in our communities. More and more people are deinstitutionalized. They're on medications. When they fail to take those medications, they have problems that require police intervention. Domestic violence is a big problem in all our communities. So we see the same things in the smallest towns, in the biggest cities. The question is how often we see them, but we see all those same problems wherever we go.
Anybody else?
I think one of the big things is we move forward with the technology and we move forward with what's correct and how we do policing. We still need to look backwards and not forget the things that got us the community policing aspects. And I think sometimes we get budgeted out of a lot of the programs for the children in the schools and that. And that's kind of where the focus is right now in Pembroke, is to get some of those programs back in and get the police back involved with the community on the basic level.
How much of a challenge is it when it comes time for your budgets? I mean, we're just a few short months, depending on when your town meeting is. We got to, put together your department, get your numbers, and then not only submit them to a finance committee, but then you got to go before your town meeting if that's your type of government. How does that work for all you gentlemen as far as being a habit, have to do that? Is it different every year, Chief Tavares?
No, it's basically the same process every year. However, we've been cut in the past, and we've never seemed to recover from that. Again, we're so short-handed. Down 16 offices in a small community like Marshfield means a lot. I'm real proud that the school committee, for the first time in 20 years of having an officer in the school, has agreed to pay for 80% of his salary. So we do have a full-time presence in the school. This year for the first time in a while. But the process is always the same, and it's always falls down to shortfalls in the revenue. So, and that affects everything that happens out on the street.
I feel like I'm the only one hogging
the mic. I've been blessed with a very supportive mayor and town council. Since I was promoted chief a little over 2 years ago, we've hired about 15 or 16 officers. As I said, we just got five out of the academy. We have 6 in the academy now, so our full strength is 80. We're at 81, actually, and that's through the support of the mayor and the town council to find the money to do these things. I mean, obviously, every department wants their piece of the pie, the school department, the highway, the fire department, the police, obviously, and it's a balancing act. But we've been very fortunate in Braintree that public safety is very important. We've been able to field a school resource officer at our high school, two community service officers, one each of our junior high schools, and juvenile officers as well. So we're doing very well right now. I'm very happy to say.
Anybody else want to weigh in on this? Do you have a question?
Yeah, I do have a two-part question. First, I want to start with, I think it'd be interesting for our listeners to hear a quick bio about the backgrounds of each one of the chiefs, because people probably don't know. And then my second part of the question is going to be, talk about community policing. I know through the years, certain towns have done the Citizens Academy. I did the one in Pembroke, actually, in 1999. Had a blast.
Where's your badge?
I do have my little badge that, okay. I did my ride along with Officer Burns. Need I say anything else?
You need to say no more.
He's like a real life Clint Eastwood. I know some towns do them, some towns don't. I know sometimes it's been an issue of philosophy or money. I'd like to know where the chiefs stand on if they think it's a good idea or not a good idea. But first, I'd like to hear a little bit about the background of each one of them, because they come from different backgrounds. Let's start here with Chief Russ Jenkins, Braintree.
Well, I'm in my 32nd year with the department. I came on in 1983, went up the ranks, sergeant lieutenant, deputy chief. Went to Northeastern University for my bachelor's degree back in, I graduated in 1975. And that's it in a nutshell. All right, that's me.
Okay. Let's go down to Chief Benton.
I started in 86 with the police department, moved up through, did different jobs, sergeant, detective sergeant, prosecutor. I was the town's first air officer, coach sports in the town, deputy chief, and then chief. So I also went to Curry, got my master's degree in Curry, and went to the FBI National Academy, session 239. So... That's my bio.
Chief Phil Tavares.
Certainly. I started working for the town in 1988 as the assistant animal control officer.
Lucky guy.
I did that for a couple of years and moved up to first assistant harbor master, then acting harbor master, then became a permanent intermittent police officer, full-time police officer, was promoted to sergeant, was promoted to lieutenant, was promoted to captain, and September 1st of 2012 was promoted to chief. I've got a bachelor's degree from Salem State University. I've got a master's degree from Western New England College, and I'm a graduate of the 231st FBI National Academy in Quantico.
Chief Wall?
Well, I grew up in the town of Pembroke. After I got out of the military, a friend of mine was a special police officer, and my father was a special police officer, and I kind of got talked into trying it out, and after doing some auxiliary time, some special time, decided I like it, and I had an opportunity to become a full-time officer in 86. It's a great job. I was a detective for several years, was a sergeant for 15 years on the street, and then the opportunity to become chief about 2 years ago with the rest of this crowd here came upon me, so I took that. And again, I've been involved in Pembroke in the Boy Scouts and in a lot of the youth programs and everything else for years, and continue to do so as time allows.
Okay, before I get to that second part of the question about community policing, everybody kind of gave me their resume or their dossier. In two sentences, I'd like you to give me the personal side of why you decided to become a police chief. I know where you went to school. I know your degrees. Was it something that motivated? Was it a great job? Was it something that you wanted to do from the time you were a kid? Just curiosity. Chief Jenkins?
When I was a kid, it's something I had wanted to do all my life. I can't say why. I don't know why. Probably the influence of television and just growing up as a young boy, but it's one I've always wanted to do.
Okay. What about you, Chief Benton?
It was something, honestly, that I really never thought that I'd do. I had a dad retire from Brockton PD, an uncle from East Bridgewater. It wasn't. I was working at Shaw's Warehouse, and I said, I need a job with some job security. And police just, it was a family thing, and that's, in the end, where I went to. I'm glad I did, I mean, but I didn't, it wasn't on my radar screen to high school or anything like that.
Okay. Chief Tavares?
Sure. Right around the time I turned 18, I had some bad experiences with law enforcement, and it motivated me to join them, hold them accountable for their actions, and try to eventually lead a police department and professionalize them.
Okay. What about you, Chief Wall?
I think it was an opportunity. Things just kind of happened, and when they happened, you have to wonder why, and you take advantage of that opportunity, and that's what I'm doing now.
Okay. So let's ask you about that community policing question. So I guess nobody here ever wanted to be a reporter, huh? Well, that got a good laugh. I knew it would. Community policing, what do you think? Citizens Academy. As I said, I did it in Pembroke in 1999 with Bill Bolter, and it was really fun. I loved it. I had a great time.
I
you guys still doing
outstanding.
It?
No, we don't. A lot of the programs that we were able to do, we used to get a lot of community police grants from different entities, and pretty much all of that money's dried up. And you know, we've gotten to the point now where we're a reactive police department. We handle as much as we can. Recently, we put guys back into the elementary schools, the high school, and in the middle school, only a couple hours a week, not on a full-time basis, but as extra on their job. And we're working right now. I was talking to the guy today that's taken over for housing for the elderly to be their liaison, to try and get back to that relationship between our department and the schools and in housing and some of the other community groups. So we're working towards that.
Okay. What do you think? Citizens Academy in Marshfield, Chief Tavares?
I think it's a great idea. There's a lot of different programs out there that I'd love to institute. However, due to budgetary constraints, we're just not able to do it. We do offer a number of other programs. We just graduated a class from the RAD, Rape Aggression Defense Training, last month. That was held at the New Marshfield High School. We are involved with the children and after-school activities, the police athletic league. We're just starting up now, and the officers are interacting with the children. We have neighborhood watch programs. We do a number of different things. Our officers are coaches in the community. I coach five different sports. I'm on the board of directors for the Boys and Girls Club and so on and so forth. So we're in tight with the community, but we haven't started the community policing program up yet for our Citizens Academy.
And I'm not as familiar with Whitman, Chief Benton. Have they ever had the Citizens Academy there? Have they ever done that?
No, we haven't, but actually I have on my desk, I just was looking at it, the Citizens Police Academy information from Bridgewater. It is something that we are planning on doing. Right now, we upgraded our weapons. We from 40s to 45s Glocks. We went to tasers. We're in the middle of doing certification for accreditation, which is a big process. One of the things that we do is we have a center patrol, a foot patrol, that we do that the businesses like it, especially at the holidays. We have the officers go in and out. We have a jewelry store, the banks, and things like that. So that's been a big hit. We do that. We are going to do the Citizens Police Academy. That's something I hope to do in the spring. We also we do Kids Rad, the Adult Rad. So, just as Chief Tavares said, you know, same thing. We have a number of officers that are involved in youth sports and things like that. So we're interwoven into the community, but I think anything that you can do with your community, that you make them an ally, because we all know at town meeting, it's nice to have a citizen stand up and be able to say, mm-hmm. hey, you know what, this is what they have to do. That's why they need that. So. Mm-hmm. I do think it's a great thing, but I also understand, you know, budgets and different things drive sometimes what we can or can't do.
Okay. What about you, Chief Jenkins? Have they ever done that in Braintree? I'm not sure they have or they haven't.
We did it back when there was a lot of community policing money. We had both a Citizens Academy and a Youth Academy in the summertime. And we got away from both of those, though, because of funding. However, just this past September, I named two officers to be community service officers, and their full-time job now is to work within the community, within the schools, with the elderly population, with our neighborhood groups. And one of the things, or two of the things I hope that they can accomplish is to resurrect both the Youth Academy in the summertime, hopefully this summer, possibly, and also the Adult Academy at nighttime, maybe as soon as this spring. One of the issues is getting someone to spearhead it, and these two officers are very, they're full of ideas, they've got a lot of energy, and I look for great things to happen from them. So I am hopeful that both those academies will be running sometime in 2015.
Thanks.
Kevin? Let me make sure I don't, either one of you gentlemen have a question?
Yeah, I actually was wondering, you know, obviously communities grow and change over the years. In your time, not necessarily just as police chiefs, but as members of police forces, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen happen in the local communities over the last, say, you know, 10 to 15 years? And in terms of policing and in terms of the crimes that you are, you know, you're dealing with within your communities.
Where do you want to go first?
We can start, we've been starting on the right. We'll start on the left now.
Some of the changes in the last 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
We've I think, become more reactive to dealing with, again, the amount of domestic violence crimes has gone up, that we have to deal with a lot more mental illness issues almost on a day-to-day basis with people that, you know, need hospitalization and everything else. So there's a lot of social work on that aspect. And it's we've also lost the DARE officer and some of the programs that we had because we have to spend the manpower taking care of the, you know, crisis management, the things that we have to do right off. So that's one of the things I've seen change within our town.
Chief Tavares?
Sure. In the last 10 or 15 years, we've gotten a lot busier with the advances in technology. Everybody's got a cell phone now. Everybody's calling in an erratic operator. You know, there's a lot more people being arrested for, you know, operating under the influence, you know. With the advances in technology, we've got a lot of different crimes that we're have to investigate now that take time and a certain expertise to it, the computer-related crimes. But our biggest, by far, our biggest problem, in my opinion, is the opiate addiction that's going on right now. It's an epidemic right now. And all the residual crimes that come about because of the addiction. You know, I'd say 85 to 90% of all of our crimes in some fashion are related to drug and alcohol use and abuse. So it's that's really taken a toll on us, specifically within the last 10 years.
Chief Benton?
Yes, I would agree. I mean, everything is driven. You know, you'll find that the addiction drives vehicle B&Es, house B&Es. I mean, those are the things that, unfortunately, you know, that's what we're dealing with on a large scale. And also, with technology, there's always good and there's bad. You have identity theft, you know, is kind of going through the roof. And as Chief Tavares said, it's not as simple as, oh, that's the guy. You would try to trace these IP addresses back, and they can use an IP address in, like, Iowa that somehow they're able to bounce it around. And you just, to find these people just takes hours and hours, and it's all consuming. So, though that's, you know, that's some of the things I see.
Chief Jenkins?
I have to get all these comments here. I mean, I see a tremendous increase in the mental health issues, cybercrime type things. Your online bullying is a big problem now. Your identity theft crimes, they take up a lot of detectives' time investigating those types of crimes. The drug problem is an epidemic. We're seizing drugs off of shoplifters in quantities that we used to do a two-month investigation to find on a drug dealer. We'll grab a guy for shoplifting, and he's got trafficking weight heroin in his back pocket. So it's just crazy the amount of drugs that we're seeing right now. All these problems are driving us. So they're making us busier, more calls for service. You know, our daytime crime is increased significantly from what it was years ago as well.
Not only daytime crime, we've got, six turbo scanners there in the newsroom. We listen to all Southeastern Mass, police, fire, Med Flight, Coast Guard, State Police. We hear a lot of nonsense calls, more so than ever. I'm just going to be very blunt. It's like your guys have to be frontline social workers. I don't ever remember 10 years ago, I would never hear people calling police 911 because they have, quote, as I heard today, an out-of-control 7-year-old child. And I hear this a lot now, and I'm thinking, do people call you for everything? I mean, that seems to me like a tremendous waste of your time.
Well, let me address that. I mean, that's the optimist they want to send to people, because what we tell Ross all the time is that it may seem trivial to them, but the person who dialed 911, that's a real emergency of that person. You know, that 7-year-old kid's out of control, that they can't control, that's a huge problem for that person. And it's a true emergency, and they need our help. And so, you know, we want to encourage our officers to take that call and provide the level of service that person demands and is entitled to, and treat it as, again, it's like a surgeon who does the same operation 1,000 times. He's very very matter of fact, very cold, very callous. I'm gonna cut you open and do this and do that, and you're horrified to hear this whole description what he's gonna do. But to him, it's just another day at work. Well, it's the same thing with us. We see these calls all the time, so it's no big deal to us. But to that one person, this is the first time they've called the police in their whole life because they have a real emergency because their kid's out of control or whatever the case may be, and we have to realize it for what it is. It's their emergency, their little moment of crisis that we're being called to intervene with.
Now, are you dealing with more of those calls? Because just as speaking anecdotally, it seems like we listen to more of those kinds of calls.
We deal with them all the time. We're driving kids to school because they won't go to school. We're dealing with those little crises with we call them in our day temper tantrums, you know. But now it's a police matter, you know.
On the other end of the spectrum, Christine, right, we're getting calls from kids who's who are calling 911 on their parents.
That's right.
Because they took their iPad or their cell phone away.
You also had an interesting call recently with a young child on a parent that involved heroin, as I remember.
That's right. That's exactly right.
You're shaking your head, Chief Benton. You concur, I think, with your colleagues.
Yeah, I do. I mean, these are the times that we live in. Do I necessarily agree with it in some aspects? No, but, it's something that we have to deal with, as Chief Jenkins said. you know, it's a desperate thing for the person who has that emergency going on. I think, though, we all go back to when we were kids and things were just handled a little differently.
Correct.
You know, right, wrong, or indifferent. I mean, sometimes, you know, I understand why people shake their heads, because it's something that, quite honestly, is a family issue. But for the times and everything that are going on, I think everybody's afraid of that. Oh, am I going to, you know, have somebody called DSS on me, or DCF, or am I going to? So they kind of, we're the referee. We're the ones that have to get there and kind of make sure, okay, this is how we're going to do this. So it can be frustrating. I won't say that it isn't, but obviously it's something that every police officer does, and it's their job to do. You know, we understand that. But
Chief Hall?
Yeah, there are a lot of situations, but, I mean, our job is to protect and serve. And I think a lot of times people forget we have that service part. And, you know, we may not have all the answers, but at least we can help them find a solution to their problem. And that's what a lot of it is. And the earlier you can deal with it, you know, maybe you can help that one person in crisis, and then they can move on.
I've heard similar stories, not only from police officers, police departments, but also from the fire department. And it seems as though when people are in need, they'll call either your department or they'll call the fire department. I've heard stories about, you know, I need to take my, you know, elderly people who may not have somebody, I need to take my air conditioner out. Or I heard a noise in the garage. Can you come down and make sure that it's not, you know, a wild or rabid animal? So both, I think the fire and police are counted on more than just to, you know, arrest the criminals or, you know, put out a fire. It's more than that.
Okay, and I have two personal times when the police have helped me out. One time, state police, when my car broke down, the one time in 24 years, at 4 o'clock in the morning on Route 3, the troopers stayed with my car and waited for AAA, so I got to work and on the air on time. And thank you to Marshfield Police one morning when I was getting ready to go on the air, and an intern had taken my keys, and I couldn't get in. Two officers helped me get into the building, and that's all I'm going to say. Right on time.
We're
thank
supposed
you.
To talk about that, Christine.
Of course, you've been listening to a segment with four South Shore police chiefs, Chief Russ Jenkins, Marshfield Chief Phil Tavares, Pembroke Chief Richard Wall, and Whitman Fire Chief, Police Chief Scott Benton, who are in studio for another half hour. We'll continue to talk about their jobs and policing, community policing, a lot more right here on Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD. Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we are back for the second half of our South Shore Police Chief Roundtable, featuring police chiefs from Braintree, Marshfield, Pembroke, and Whitman. In studio is Russ Jenkins, Scott Benton, Phil Tavares, and Richard Wall, and they have been kind enough to be here for an hour to talk about a number of things. We spent the first half hour kind of getting to know them, getting to know what they are dealing with. Of course, joining me is Christine James, who is our managing news editor here at 95.9 WATD. Peter Brown, who is one of our sponsors, also with Tiny and Sons Glass, and Joe Rossi, who is my co-host on a regular basis. And I guess I want to kind of change gears. You gentlemen have mentioned a couple of different times already about the growing drug epidemic, and I want to give you guys a moment to kind of talk about that. You guys are on the ground level. You see it. Your men and women are out there dealing with this. Give me your thoughts on where things stand right now dealing with this epidemic, and what you feel might need to be done in for future policing, if you will. And we'll start with Chief Wall first.
I know there's a lot of conversation, there's a lot of action. In Pembroke, they're actually starting a coalition, anti-drug coalition, and it's getting a lot of traction right now because of the number of not over just the overdoses, but the number of people that are afflicted by substance abuse, the users, the families, the businesses. I mean, it hits. Nobody's untouched by this.
Everybody.
So, you know, the first thing they, you know, we need is conversation. We need to get that moving, and now we need to get some action on that. What are we going to do? And that's where we're at right now.
Chief Tavares?
Well, in Marshfield, we started, going back 2 years now, the prescription drug drop-off program, because we believe that, you know, that's kind of where the abuse starts taking place and leads to the addiction of heroin. And that's been, you know, we've received thousands and thousands of pounds of unwanted, unused medication. We just got an MOU signed with BI Plymouth Hospital to carry Narcan and AEDs in the car. Because typically we're first on scene, and hopefully by administering Narcan, we can save some lives. We continue to do the education public outreach, and then the last piece is we will still continue to do our enforcement efforts. The three of us are part of the Old Colony Police Anti-Crime Task Force, and Russ and I are part of Metrolec, and you know, we all work together and share information to hopefully stop the drug dealers from dealing in our communities.
Chief Benton?
Yeah, we're doing similar things. We joined the Brockton Mayor's Opioid Overdose Coalition. Mm-hmm. We also carry Narcan now. We see the same things that communities do. I think, though, you have to go back to, you look at, like, Purdue Pharmaceutical, who knew when they made this how addicting it was, yet it was still produced because, let's not forget the other side of this coin, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, nobody was prepared for what damage this has caused. And it has affected everybody, whether it's the addict's family who's trying to keep them alive, or it's the person who was victimized by the addict who's trying to get the money to buy the drugs. So it's certainly something that is going to be talked about. I don't know what the answer is. I think we're all addressing it. And I think, you know, as Chief Wall said, I think it's going to be something that as we continue to go, we're just going to keep, it's going to evolve, and it's going to change. So,
Chief Jenkins?
Well, we have a very active and aggressive drug unit in Braintree that does a great job on the enforcement end of it. We also have a substance abuse partnership in town in Braintree, where we bring people from all disciplines together to try to work on some issues that could address the overdose problem, the drug problem. Just last Wednesday, we had an opiate night where we were very surprised that it was a huge turnout. It was a great turnout to see so many people that they came to be part of this program, and it also shows you just what the magnitude of the problem is. D.A. Morrissey in Norfolk County has spearheaded the Narcan program. He's made it possible for every police and fire department in Norfolk County to carry Narcan in their cruisers and on their fire apparatus, and we're saving lives on a regular basis throughout Norfolk County. I think that we've had 65 overdose deaths in the county since the first of the year. And we've probably saved twice that many people throughout the county in that same period of time. That kind of gives you an idea what the magnitude of the problem is. The DA is also working on a prescription monitoring program where pharmacists can register and they can track what people are getting for prescriptions. So when an individual goes shopping, they go to several doctors, they go to several pharmacies, and they're stockpiling on narcotics, the pharmacists can see this and they can report that. One of the big problems that's also out there that we have to address is the overprescribing of prescription drugs by doctors and dentists for routine procedures that maybe don't require the type of a prescription. And that oftentimes leads to addiction, or it gives someone the ability to take those unneeded, unused drugs and sell them on the street. We've had that issue as well, where we dealt with.
Peter?
That was one of the things that Chief Wall and I were talking about one time at our shop, was the problem with employees, and that's how we figured out some of our employees were drug addicts, because they were switching doctors constantly. I was lucky enough to go to a meeting with Chief Wall for the Pembroke Titans Against Drugs. And they had probably, 40 people at that meeting. And they've gone to the grassroots levels, to the schools, to get the kids are actually get involved to educate these people, to let them know what the bad things about the drugs. But one of the things that concerns me is that the overprescription end of it, and maybe the pharmaceutical people should be held accountable for it. And if they're going to prescribe it, they should also be prescribing people to, how do people get off these drugs. They should be doing a two-edged prescription. Because what the problem I'm seeing is that, specifically from the employees, is that once they go in, they get these prescriptions, and they can switch doctors to get them again, and there's no recourse to it.
The Norfolk County D's office has a pharmacist on their staff, and what he's doing, we did it in Braintree last week, and he's been in some other communities in Norfolk County as well, and they're going to hit them all eventually, is they're joining with the chief of police and or his or her designee, and they're going to every pharmacy in that community, and they're talking to the pharmacist about, hey, listen, are you on this program? If you're on this program, here's the information. Can you get on this program? They explain how important it is to get on this program and to make use of it. And it was refreshing to see that some of the pharmacists were very much involved with it. In particular, one young lady she's like a spare, so she travels around from different pharmacies and doesn't get to know the customers. So she's always dealing with unknown people. So she's able to go right on the computer and check this guy out or this gal out and see, you know, what their prescription history is, and that's a red flag. So there are programs that are out there that can help to address these problems you speak of. These have to be used.
Right. Anybody else want to kind of comment on this? No?
I think Peter's right about the grassroots level and everything else. We're going to have to hit it on all the different sides. You know, you have to take care of it at home. We recommended to the parents to take and empty out their medicine cabinet with their kids and then bring it down to the police station and explain to them why they're putting it in the box and why they're getting rid of the unused prescription. Because you need the awareness. You need the education. You know, we need to reach the kids in the school with the education.
How young? Is it young enough now? Or does it need to go even younger?
As young as they can understand. Okay. Because you make it a habit. You know, when they're at work, they have, you know, the support of their employees if they have a problem. And a lot of companies have employee assistance programs for people that have drug or alcohol issues, substance abuse. The courts are dealing with it. They have a drug court where if the crimes are committed to support a drug habit, then they're trying to get these people into a rehab, you know, that, you know, more than 30 days that they can actually get something out of it. So they're not committing crimes for drugs. They're actually getting beyond that. So it has to be hit on all different levels, not just the police can't just arrest their way out of this problem.
You have to change the culture. I liken this to before Mothers Against Drunk Driving got involved. I'm old enough to remember what the culture was like before with just people would drink, get in their car and drive. And that was really a sea change in the population. When Mothers Against Drunk Driving, they were the driving force to getting the idea with alcohol. So how do you change the culture? How do you change the influence where kids are, they know it's bad, but they're still doing it. And I think that's part of it. We're talking about elementary school and grassroots, but how do you change the culture? Hey, this is cool, this is great, try these Oxys or Percocets.
I think the message has to be the same from everybody. So everywhere they go, they get the same message that it's not good, that it can lead to, you know, it can ruin your life.
Do you think it might take a generation? Lives. It might take a generation?
It may, but it has to come from every direction. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to come down, it has to go up, it has to come from every direction, it has to be the same message, and that's how I see it.
Definitely.
Joe?
You know, kind of on that subject, you know, how important is it to, and what is your involvement been, and I know Chief Tavares, you talked about it a second ago or a little while ago, is getting involved at the school level, you know, what you're doing inside the school. And also, you know, now that medical marijuana has been legalized in Massachusetts, how are you as departments dealing with what could be the results of that, such as, you know, more exposure to kids and adults alike of marijuana?
I think that was at you, Chief Tavares.
Yeah. We do a number of different things in the schools. I have a police officer assigned to every school, the 7 schools here in Marshfield. So there's a different police officer that's a liaison to the schools for any problems that they have. They can call them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We continue to do the public outreach and education campaign. We speak to parents about the dangers of drug abuse, where it all starts, how to identify it.
The school just recently put on a, I think it's called Hidden in Plain Sight, where they have like a mock bedroom, and they show the parents all the places they should be looking, what they should be looking for signs and of drug use, or what drugs look like, how to identify them. Maybe that answers the first part of the question. The second part is this whole marijuana issue, you know, it's only going to get worse, and we're only going to see more drugged drivers. As a result of more drugged drivers on our roads, we're going to see more accidents, more people are going to get hurt. I don't think that it's a good thing. However, it's the reality that we're dealing with now. I think that it's something when the kids in the community can walk around with just under an ounce of marijuana, and there's not a whole lot you can do to them. And they seem to think that that's okay, to go to school high or drive around in a car high, as opposed to, you know, if they're caught with a can of beer, we can arrest them. The marijuana, we can't. So it's disappointing.
Yeah, the chief want to weigh in on that?
I want to ask you. We've talked about the drug issue. That's a major issue. But the past couple of weeks, we've seen another issue, and I want to get your thoughts on what we've seen going on in Ferguson and Staten Island. And being somebody who's administrators of your departments, what do you think when you see this going on, and the, you know, the mentality of folks, how they feel about the police at this moment when they're out there marching, and they feel that departments didn't do the right thing. And we're talking about two different departments, and they're looking at the situation. What's your thoughts on these situations?
Well, I'll jump in. it's a hot topic. The bottom line, I think, with this is that none of us are in a position to draw any real conclusion on it, because we're not privy to all the information that the grand jury was. We didn't look at all the evidence that the grand jury did. And we have to have faith in the justice system, because that's all that we have. And they made their decision, and we have to respect that. It certainly doesn't give the right for criminals to go out and destroy people's property, start fires, steal people's, destroy and steal people's property. So it's certainly, if the police have done something wrong, there is absolutely no question they should be made an example out of and held accountable. In these particular cases, none of us were there and are privy to the information. So I think we have to just have faith in the justice system.
You think the media is biased, national media, in covering these stories?
Can I jump in on that?
Yeah, sure.
I do think so. Let me just jump on what Phil said, first of all, when he said we have to be held accountable. And the fact is, we were, okay? We were held accountable, both in Ferguson and in New York City. A grand jury sat on the case. They heard the evidence, and as Phil said, we haven't, okay? So we don't know all the evidence in these cases. All these people who are talking about what happened in Ferguson, New York City, have not heard all the evidence. A lot of what they're saying, they're acting on misinformation. They've been told that it's misinformation, but they still haven't changed their tune, all right? I think that the scientific evidence and the testimony in the Ferguson case speak for themselves, but people still insist that Michael Brown's hands are up and he was surrendering. But again, let me back up again, that they were held accountable, that this wasn't broomed under the rug. It wasn't that no one hid anything. A grand jury heard the facts and they made a decision. And it wasn't the police who, first of all, I don't think anybody did anything wrong in the sense of the decision, but the police didn't do anything wrong here. It was the grand jury who made the decision not to indict Darren Wilson, not to indict the New York City police officer. So the police officer were involved in certain actions, all right? But again, the grand jury heard the facts, and the grand jury made the decision. It wasn't a chief of police saying, my officer's innocent, I'm not going to punish him, all right? So that's what I want to say about that. And I already forgot what you just said there.
Do you think the media coverage is biased?
Absolutely. The media, I think, has been fanning the fire, and there's quite a bit.
Sensationalizing it.
I think that they have. And quite frankly, I fear that it's to the point now where it's almost driving people to further resist the police. I think that you're going to see more resistance to police authority because of what's going on with the media today. And there's been a lot of talk on the national level, from the national level all the way on down, about, you know, what the police should be doing, et cetera, et cetera. But what about what the public should do? You know, the public should not resist the police. Okay, that's the bottom line. And what happened in Ferguson, what happened in New York City, what happened in Cleveland, Ohio, terrible tragedies. But they all start, the common theme is that the individuals resisted the police officer's lawful authority to effect an arrest or to detain or whatever the case may be. But the police officer had a legal authority to do what he was doing, and that person resisted that police officer's authority. And that's what started this whole, the events that unfolded. And if people would not resist the police, you know, if people would come out and proclaim that, as loud as they're proclaiming other things, maybe we would have a fewer instances like this happen around the country.
Any other chief want to weigh in on this? No?
I think it has to come down to, over the years, the police have become more isolated from the community, and it breaks down that relationship and that trust. And that's kind of an overarching, you know, what I see is part of the bigger issue that goes on here, and that needs to be reversed. We need to be more entrenched in the community and develop those trusts.
And again, kind of on that, do you see, in relation to all this, do you see a kind of a decline of, I guess respect is the best word, towards the police in your dealings within the last few years?
I guess I want to just kind of jump in. Sure. I think Chief Benton wanted to kind of respond before you asked the question. Sure. But if you want to respond to the original question I asked, and then Joe's, you can do that.
Sure. I think that this becomes an issue of who's breaking the law. And that's really what this is about. It's the police officers taking action when somebody does something that they're not supposed to. That's our job. So it's to just blanketly throw out, and I agree with what Chief Jenkins says, that the way that this is being driven and the direction that it's going, they're encouraging people to keep resisting the police. You don't have to do what they want you to do. No way. This is what it is. And then for whatever reason, they want people that have their own agenda want to throw a tag on it and say, well, we're going to call it this, when that's not what it is. It's not like the police are going and picking an innocent person up off the sidewalk and saying, guess what? Mm. We're going to spray you and kick you and throw you around a little bit. That's not what's going on here. So there's no textbook. You know, when somebody resists, it's your job to bring them in. So you have all kinds of policies, procedures, and things that you follow. So then, could you have not maybe followed a policy or followed a procedure? Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. But it doesn't make you a racist, or it doesn't make you a bully. That's not what it does. So, you know, it's frustrating because there's a slant on this in this country. It's getting to a point where, you know, I don't know where we're headed. I don't like where we're headed. I can tell you that. I don't think it's good for anybody. I don't think it's good for the public, and it's certainly not good for law enforcement.
Now, what was your question?
Well, I guess, you know, I had said, you know, have you noticed a decline in respect towards, you know, arresting officers within the last, you know, say 10 years? But I don't know if respect's the right word. I guess, you know, has this issue been something that's highlighted by these incidents, but you've noticed, you know, over the last, you know, number of years of this, not the type of police work that was either done or not done, but the type of, you know, people that are resisting the police, that type of thing?
I think respect is a good word to use, and I think it goes beyond the police. I think if you talk to school teachers, you find that they don't get the respect in the schools they used to get 20, 10 years ago. Yeah. So I think that society as a whole is less respectful of all people, whether it be a common courtesy respect or again, respect in the school, with law enforcement, in public assemblies, with any type of authority. I think there's, without a doubt, a decline in respect in all those disciplines.
Any other chief want to weigh in on Joe's question?
I think one of the issues that I think Chief Wall brought up in the beginning is the public policing, getting to know the people in their communities. And the issue that I see myself is that the money's not there to do it. So, it, like you said, it's a reactionary force instead of a receptive force. And to this issue, that the only way we can get the respect that they deserve is for them to get to know the people that are out there. And to get to know the people that are out there, they need the time to go do it.
I got to ask. I know that the president just signed for a $263 million initiative to put out badge cams. And it's, I don't know if it's how that's going to work as far as if this is something that's dispersed to various departments across the country, if departments want to be a part of this experiment, or if this is something, a wave of the future. What do you guys, how do you guys feel badge cameras will either hurt or help your effort to protect the public?
I think you're going to see them on every police officer in the coming years. But if you do the math, they probably cost about $1,000 a piece, and there's probably 700,000 police officers in America. So there's a little short on the money to put them on every police officer with the president's plan. I'm not going to say they're not a good thing, because they're a good thing, but they have their limitations. That they're not a magic bullet. For example, the camera it has no perception. Okay, all it does is it records what is in front of it. Mm-hmm. All right, it doesn't perceive. It doesn't know what the police officer knows. So when the police officer responds to a call, and that call was an armed robbery or an assault and battery, the camera doesn't know that, but the police officer does, and certainly his or her actions are going to be dictated by what he or she knows. All right. The camera also has better visual acuity than the police officer may have. These are pretty good cameras, all right? My eyes aren't what they were when I was a young kid, all right? So when a guy reaches to his waistband and removes his cell phone, the camera may see that's a cell phone. My eyes may just see the glint from an overhead streetlight at 2 in the morning, and I think because I'm responding to a robbery call that that's a gun coming out of his waistband.
Right.
And so I take action. Well, the camera, now when that camera footage is reviewed in slow motion, frame by frame, by judges, juries, the media, and the public, over a course of weeks and months, and I only had a split second to decide what am I seeing and react to it, you know, that's an issue, all right? So there are a lot of things to consider when we talk about cameras. But the biggest thing that I want to bring out is this, that if we have become a society where we can't trust the police unless we have video footage to back up what he or she says, then we're in a bad place, okay? We're not going into this camera policy or program the right way. Because the way I see it, we're going into it because we can't be trusted, and that's not good.
Chief Tavares?
There's a debate going on right now whether the business exemption to the state wiretap statute applies to police officers. It's Chapter 272, Section 99, D1. It's basically a business exemption, and there's a debate going on right now whether or not that does apply to police officers. So secretly record audio, not video, but audio of a police, the police doing that, may be a felony. So the Massachusetts Police Chiefs Association is working on legislation to ensure that we can do that legally first. And I would say that the audio portion would be key in conjunction with the video portion. So I'd like to have both if we're going to do it, not just the audio.
Well, we've
video, been, excuse me, the not just the video.
Okay. Well, we've been speaking with four South Shore police chiefs. We just got a couple of minutes left here. Anything either any of my co-hosts here want to say or any
just,
of you gentlemen
just a
say?
Quick question, please. In the newsroom it's always who, what, when, where, why, but yep. it's always want to quantify how much. And it's interesting that a lot of people on TV, the talking heads talking about the police shootings, people like to throw generalizations about there are all these quote shootings. I don't know how many there are. There could be one a year. There could be 100. I don't know what the racial makeup. Are there any of those statistics available? Because it seems like people are saying things that are just not accurate. It's not backed up by fact. I'm talking about people complaining about there's all these shootings. Well, I don't know if there are or there aren't. That's something I really don't know.
You know, Christine, there's more people killed by police pursuits across the country than by officers' guns. And, here in Massachusetts, failure to stop for a police officer is just a $100 fine. And I think that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. so many people get killed as a result of a pursuit.
Chief Benton?
I just want to say that, first of all, less than half of 1% of all law enforcement officers ever do anything to discredit or disgrace that badge. And I do agree, you know, that it's almost to the point now where the police officers, like when I was a kid, we were raised, the adult was assumed correct. Now it's the police officers are assumed to be at fault. We have to prove what we're doing, as Chief Jenkins said. And when a society isn't going to trust those police officers, and we have to prove, this is why we did it, and this is, then we are in a really bad spot. Because, as I said, less than half of 1% of all law enforcement officers in the world ever do anything to discredit that. That's, I think it speaks for itself.
Chival?
I know that every day when I get ready to go out and do what I got to do, you know, I just pray that I'm up and capable of doing whatever it is that gets thrown out in front of me and do it right and to be able to make that difference, you know. So that's pretty much the mantra of every police officer that's out there. You know, we're not out there looking to do anything but the best that we can do with what's thrown at us. So that's what I want to leave you with tonight.
I want to thank all four of you for coming in. Anybody want to say anything else in closing? Well, I want to thank Christine, and I want to thank Peter and Joe for being a part of this, as well as Chief Wall, Chief Tavares, Chief Benton, and Chief Jenkins for being a part of the program. And maybe we can explore this sometime next year, have you gentlemen back in. Maybe it'll be a different climate, maybe things will be a bit better, or maybe we'll have some new issues to discuss. Okay?
Thank you.
We're going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.